Chapter 6. After 2 years of hungry roaming, Mrs. Barda died of a deep disgust. She had hated dinginess, and it was her fate to be dingy. Her visions of a brilliant marriage for Lily had faded after the first year. People can't marry you if they don't see you, and how can they see you in these holes where we're stuck? That was the burden of her lament. And her last adjuration to her daughter was to escape from dinginess if she could. Don't let it creep up on you and drag you down. Fight your way out of it somehow. You're young and can do it, she insisted. She had died during one of their brief visits to New York, and their Lily at once became the center of a family council composed of the wealthy relatives whom she had been taught to despise for living like pigs. It may be that they had an inkling of the sentiments in which S.E. had been brought up, for none of them manifested a very lively desire for her company. Indeed, the question threatened to remain unsolved till Mrs. Peniston with a sigh announced, "Colin, I'll try her for a year." Everyone was surprised, but one and all concealed their surprise, lest Mrs. Peniston should be alarmed by it into reconsidering her decision. Mrs. Peniston was Mr. Bart's widowed sister, and if she was by no means the richest of the family group, its other members nevertheless abounded in reasons why she was clearly destined by Providence to assume the charge of Lily. In the first place, she was alone, and it would be charming for her to have a young companion. Then she sometimes traveled, and Lily's familiarity with foreign customs, deplored as a misfortune by her more conservative relatives, would at least enable her to act as a kind of courier. But as a matter of fact, Mrs. Peniston had not been affected by these considerations. She had taken the girl simply because no one else would have her, and because she had the kind of moral mauvais honte which makes the public display of selfishness difficult, though it does not interfere with its private indulgence. It would have been impossible for Mrs. Peniston to be heroic on a desert island, but with the eyes of her little world upon her, she took a certain pleasure in her act. She reaped the reward to which disinterestedness is entitled, and found an agreeable companion in her niece. She had expected to find Lily headstrong, critical, and foreign for even Mrs. Peniston, though she occasionally went abroad, had the family dread of foreignness, but the girl showed a pliancy which, to a more penetrating mind than her aunt's, might have been less reassuring than the open selfishness of youth. Misfortune had made Lily supple instead of hardening her, and a pliable substance is less easy to break than a stiff one. Mrs. Peniston, however, did not suffer from her niece's adaptability. Lily had no intention of taking advantage of her aunt's good nature. She was in truth grateful for the refuge offered her. Mrs. Peniston's opulent interior was at least not externally dingy. But dinginess is a quality which assumes all manner of disguises, and Lily soon found that it was as latent in the expensive routine of her aunt's life as in the makeshift existence of a continental pension. Mrs. Peniston was one of the episodical persons who form the padding of life. It was impossible to believe that she had herself ever been a focus of activities. The most vivid thing about her was the fact that her grandmother had been a Van Alstyne. This connection with the well-fed and industrious stock of early New York revealed itself in the glacial neatness of Mrs. Peniston's drawing room and in the excellence of her cuisine. She belonged to the class of old New Yorkers who have always lived well, dressed expensively, and done little else, and to these inherited obligations Mrs. Peniston faithfully conformed. She had always been a looker-on at life, and her mind resembled one of those little mirrors which her Dutch ancestors were accustomed to affix to their upper windows, so that from the depths of an impenetrable domesticity they might see what was happening in the street. Mrs. Peniston was the owner of a country place in New Jersey, but she had never lived there since her husband's death, a remote event which appeared to dwell in her memory chiefly as a dividing point in the personal reminiscences that formed the staple of her conversation. She was a woman who remembered dates with intensity, and could tell at a moment's notice whether the drawing room curtains had been renewed before or after Mr. Peniston's last illness. Mrs. Peniston thought the country lonely and trees damp, and cherished a vague fear of meeting a bull. To guard against such contingencies, she frequented the more populous watering places, where she installed herself impersonally in a hired house, and looked on at life through the matting screen of her veranda. In the care of such a guardian, it soon became clear to Lily that she was to enjoy only the material advantages of good food and expensive clothing, and, though far from underrating these, she would gladly have exchanged them for what Mrs. Bard had taught her to regard as opportunities. She sighed to think what her mother's fierce energies would have accomplished had they been coupled with Mrs. Peniston's resources. Lily had abundant energy of her own, but it was restricted by the necessity of adapting herself to her aunt's habits. She saw that at all costs she must keep Mrs. Peniston's favor till, as Mrs. Barth would have phrased it, she could stand on her own legs. Lily had no mind for the vagabond life of the poor relation, and to adapt herself to Mrs. Peniston as he had, to some degree, to assume that lady's passive attitude. As he had fancied at first that it would be easy to draw her aunt into the whirl of her own activities, but there was a static force in Mrs. Peniston against which her niece's efforts spent themselves in vain. To attempt to bring her into active relation with life was like tugging at a piece of furniture which has been screwed to the floor. She did not, indeed, expect Lily to remain equally immovable. As he had all the American guardian's indulgence for the volatility of youth. As he had indulgence also for certain other habits of her niece's. It seemed to her natural that Lily should spend all her money on dress, and she supplemented the girl's scanty income by occasional handsome presents meant to be applied to the same purpose. Lily, who was intensely practical, would have preferred a fixed allowance. But Mrs. Peniston liked the periodical recurrence of gratitude evoked by unexpected checks, and was perhaps shrewd enough to perceive that such a method of giving kept alive in her niece a salutary sense of dependence. Beyond this, Mrs. Peniston had not felt called upon to do anything for her charge. As he had simply stood aside and let her take the field. Lily had taken it, at first with the confidence of assured possessorship, then with gradually narrowing demands, till now she found herself actually struggling for a foothold on the broad space which had once seemed her own for the asking. How it happened she did not yet know. Sometimes she thought it was because Mrs. Peniston had been too passive, and again she feared it was because she herself had not been passive enough. Had she shown an undue eagerness for victory? Had she lacked patience, pliancy and dissimulation? Whether she charged herself with these faults, or absolved herself from them, made no difference in the sum total of her failure. Younger and plainer girls had been married off by dozens, and she was 29, and still Miss Bart. She was beginning to have fits of angry rebellion against fate, when she longed to drop out of the race, and make an independent life for herself. But what manner of life would it be? As he had barely enough money to pay her dressmaker's bills and her gambling debts, and none of the desultory interests which she dignified with the name of tastes was pronounced enough to enable her to live contentedly in obscurity. Ah, no, she was too intelligent not to be honest with herself. She knew that she hated dinginess as much as her mother had hated it, and to her last breath she meant to fight against it, dragging herself up again and again above its flood till she gained the bright pinnacles of success which presented such a slippery surface to her clutch. The next morning, on her breakfast tray, Miss Barth found a note from her hostess. "Dearest Lily," it ran, "if it is not too much of a bore to be down by 10, will you come to my sitting room to help me with some tiresome things?" Lily tossed aside the note and subsided on her pillows with a sigh. It was a bore to be down by 10 an hour regarded at Bellomont as vaguely synchronous with sunrise, and she knew too well the nature of the tiresome things in question. Miss Bragg, the secretary, had been called away, and there would be notes and dinner cards to write, lost addresses to hunt up, and other social drudgery to perform. It was understood that Miss Bart should fill the gap in such emergencies, and she usually recognized the obligation without a murmur. Today, however, it renewed the sense of servitude which the previous night's review of her checkbook had produced. Everything in her surroundings ministered to feelings of ease and amenity. The windows stood open to the sparkling freshness of the September morning, and between the yellow boughs she caught a perspective of hedges and parterres leading by degrees of lessening formality to the free undulations of the park. Her maid had kindled a little fire on the hearth, and it contended cheerfully with the sunlight which slanted across the moss-green carpet and caressed the curved sides of an old marquetry desk. Near the bed stood a table holding her breakfast tray, with its harmonious porcelain and silver, a handful of violets in a slender glass, and the morning paper folded beneath her letters. There was nothing new to Lily in these tokens of a studied luxury. But, though they formed a part of her atmosphere, she never lost her sensitiveness to their charm. Mere display left her with a sense of superior distinction, but she felt an affinity to all the subtler manifestations of wealth. Mrs. Treanor's summons, however, suddenly recalled her state of dependence, and she rose and dressed in a mood of irritability that she was usually too prudent to indulge. She knew that such emotions leave lines on the face as well as in the character, and as he had meant to take warning by the little creases which her midnight survey had revealed. The matter-of-course tone of Mrs. Treanor's greeting deepened her irritation. If one did drag oneself out of bed at such an hour, and come down fresh and radiant to the monotony of note-writing, some special recognition of the sacrifice seemed fitting. But Mrs. Treanor's tone showed no consciousness of the fact. "Oh, Lily, that's nice of you," she merely sighed across the chaos of letters, bills and other domestic documents which gave an incongruously commercial touch to the slender elegance of her writing table. "There are such lots of horrors this morning," she added, clearing a space in the center of the confusion and rising to yield her seat to Miss Bart. Mrs. Treanor was a tall, fair woman, whose height just saved her from redundancy. Her rosy blondness had survived some 40 years of feudal activity without showing much trace of ill usage except in a diminished play of feature. It was difficult to define her beyond saying that she seemed to exist only as a hostess, not so much from any exaggerated instinct of hospitality, as because she could not sustain life except in a crowd. The collective nature of her interests exempted her from the ordinary rivalries of her sex, and she knew no more personal emotion than that of hatred for the woman who presumed to give bigger dinners or have more amusing house parties than herself. As her social talents, backed by Mr. Treanor's bank account, almost always assured her ultimate triumph in such competitions, success had developed in her an unscrupulous good nature toward the rest of her sex, and in Miss Bart's utilitarian classification of her friends, Mrs. Treanor ranked as the woman who was least likely to owe back on her. "It was simply inhuman of Bragg to go off now," Mrs. Treanor declared, as her friend seated herself at the desk. "As she says her sister is going to have a baby, as if that were anything to having a house party. I'm sure I shall get most horribly mixed up, and there will be some awful rows. When I was down at Tuxedo I asked a lot of people for next week, and I've mislaid the list, and can't remember who is coming. And this week is going to be a horrid failure too, and Gwen Van Osburgh will go back and tell her mother how bored people were. I did mean to ask the Wetherills, that was a blunder of Gus's. They disapprove of Carrie Fisher, you know. As if one could help having Carrie Fisher. It was foolish of her to get that second divorce. Carrie always overdoes things, but she said the only way to get a penny out of Fisher was to divorce him and make him pay alimony. And poor Carrie has to consider every dollar. It's really absurd of Alice Wetherill to make such a fuss about meeting her when one thinks of what society is coming to. Someone said the other day that there was a divorce and a case of appendicitis in every family one knows. Besides, Carrie is the only person who can keep Gus in a good humor when we have bores in the house. Have you noticed that all the husbands like her? All, I mean, except her own. It's rather clever of her to have made a specialty of devoting herself to dull people. The field is such a large one, and she has it practically to herself. She finds compensations. No doubt I know she borrows money of Gus, but then I'd pay her to keep him in a good humor, so I can't complain, after all. Mrs. Treanor paused to enjoy the spectacle of Miss Bart's efforts to unravel her tangled correspondence. But it is only the Wetherills and Carrie, she resumed, with a fresh note of lament. The truth is, I'm awfully disappointed in Lady Cressida Wraith. Disappointed? Had you known her before? Mercy, no, never saw her till yesterday. Lady Skiddaw sent her over with letters to the Van Osburghs, and I heard that Maria Van Osburgh was asking a big party to meet her this week, so I thought it would be fun to get her away, and Jack Stepney, who knew her in India, managed it for me. Maria was furious, and actually had the impudence to make Gwen invite herself here, so that they shouldn't be quite out of it. If I'd known what Lady Cressida was like, they could have had her and welcome. But I thought any friend of the Skiddaws was sure to be amusing. You remember what fun Lady Skiddaw was? There were times when I simply had to send the girls out of the room. Besides, Lady Cressida is the Duchess of Belcher's sister, and I naturally supposed she was the same sort. But you never can tell in those English families. They are so big that there's room for all kinds, and it turns out that Lady Cressida is the moral one, married a clergyman, and does missionary work in the East End. Think of my taking such a lot of trouble about a clergyman's wife, who wears Indian jewelry and botanizes. She made Gus take her all through the glass houses yesterday, and bothered him to death by asking him the names of the plants. Fancy treating Gus as if he were the gardener. Mrs. Treanor brought this out in a crescendo of indignation. Oh, well, perhaps Lady Cressida will reconcile the Wetherills to meeting Carrie Fisher, said Miss Bart pacifically. I'm sure I hope so. But she is boring all the men horribly, and if she takes to distributing tracts, as I hear she does, it will be too depressing. The worst of it is that she would have been so useful at the right time. You know we have to have the bishop once a year, and she would have given just the right tone to things. I always have horrid luck about the bishop's visits, added Mrs. Treanor, whose present misery was being fed by a rapidly rising tide of reminiscence. Last year, when he came. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.